Israel, the West Bank, or abroad, we searched for you. If you interest Unit 8200 and have nothing to do with any hostile act.
And that brings to a close this edition of Flashpoints today. That was Max Blumenthal speaking on the 51-day war, ruin and resistance in Gaza. And that's it for Flashpoints this morning. Stay tuned to KBOO. It's 10:59, and at the top of the hour, Chris Siegel hosts The Food Show with guests Jesus Guillen and Josh Volk and others. And so stay tuned for that. That's all coming up after this announcement.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Stomp, an evening of unamplified performances by some of the region's root music acts, playing the third Saturday of each month, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the November 21st features The Earnest Lovers, Squirrel Butter, Joe New with Brian Oberlin, The Hi-O Revelers, and is hosted by country blues yodeler Zach Bryson. Again, that's the Clinton Street Stomp, Saturday, November 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Deacom Street Doorway, a Linton feed and seed store offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, garden and landscape plants from local farms and nurseries, and seed garlic. Opening are open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5:30 at Northeast Deacom and 8th entrance on 8th, deacomstreetdoorway.com. Here comes the food show.
Some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly, need some drink for the dying their throat.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. Welcome to the Food Show on KBOO. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. We have a number of exciting guests on the program today. In a little bit, we'll be talking in studio with Lisa Migrant, owner of the restaurant Raven and Rose in Southwest Portland, about ethically sourcing the very best Thanksgiving turkey and how to prepare it successfully. We'll also be hearing from farmer and small farm advocate Josh Volk about a squash he had on his counter for nearly a year before cooking it. That story leads into a conversation about dry farming and its use in a changing climate. But first, last month on the Food Show, we featured a number of the stories on the program from the Inheritance Stories Project, which features Latinos from Portland and Oregon. One of the stories was from Jesus Guillen, the head winemaker at White Rose Estate and Guillen Family Wines. Originally, Jesus had a career in Mexico as a computer programmer, but he decided to move to the United States and become a winemaker. In this interview, he talks about that move, what culture and traditions he brought with him, and the role his family plays in his life. Here's the interview with Jesus Guillen, recorded in the cellar at White Rose Estate in Dayton, Oregon.
What was it like to be in a position where you were sort of between two worlds? You weren't sure if you were going to be going back to Mexico or staying in the United States.
Okay, well, my family, like my dad, mother, brother and sister were here in the U.S. And in Mexico, I am actually a computer systems engineer. So my goal was to come to Oregon and just kind of study English and then return. So I was going to stay for like 6 months here and then, you know, return to Mexico. When the two terms of the English program were kind of done, I was in a decision of if I stay here or just return to Mexico. And I basically went on a wine tasting kind of to clear my head and decide about it. So I went to different tasting rooms, and I stumbled upon actually two of the best wines I've tried to date, which were the 1999 Arcus Estate from Archie Summit and the 1999 Elizabeth's Reserve from Alzheim. So those two wines are the ones that kind of instilled the wine bug in me to basically stay in Oregon and pursue a winemaking career. With no English, my English wasn't that good, and no winemaking skills. It was kind of like a scary decision, you know, but I had my family to back me up in the decision, so I actually kind of ended up staying. The wines were really amazing. I mean, they were really complex, and you could actually imagine yourself in like a forest, you know, they smell like forest floor, mushrooms, underbrush, like floral notes, like berry notes. So it was like an incredible experience, you know, to experience so much complexity in those wines. And that's why I loved them. That's why actually I said, you know, I gotta stay here and make something like this in the future. And that was it.
You said your family was supportive. I mean, you were going into a career in computer engineering, which is pretty straightforward, and it seems like there's sort of a lot of jobs in that. And then you decided to shift careers. They stayed supportive even though you were leaving something that was pretty solid?
Yeah, I mean, they were extremely supportive, and they still are. I mean, if anyone would be supportive of myself, I think my family is the one that, you know, kind of supported all along, because from other people I would hear things that, you know, it's not possible, you're not gonna make it like that, you know, you don't even know English, you don't even know winemaking, what are you gonna do? I mean, you have a career in Mexico already, a title and almost like a secure job. I mean, why are you gonna do this? But for myself, you know, I thought during those 6 months, I really went to different tasting rooms, developed the passion or developed the palate to appreciate the wines. And I was slowly falling in love with the wine, even though I didn't know how, you know, it was made and everything. And the final product is what it really interested me. And, you know, that's why I decided. My family was like, yeah, I mean, you can do whatever you want or whatever you set goals to or set your purpose to, and I ended up staying.
So was your family in the United States before you came?
Yes, my dad came in the year 2000, and he came back basically because in Mexico there wasn't really a lot of work to do, and one of his friends that works for another vineyard here in Oregon, Temperance Hill Vineyard, he kind of invited my dad to come to Oregon, and that's when he came. As far as my mom, sister, my brother, and myself, we arrived in the year 2002 after my dad had kind of been established a little bit here.
And what was that like, the transition of moving here? I know you didn't see it as a permanent thing at the time, but what was the sort of that cultural shift?
It was really hard. Mostly for the language first, and also because we didn't know anybody, so it was kind of hard in that manner, you know. But as the time went on, we kept going to English classes, you know, we learned a little more so we could communicate with more people, and we started to have more friends, you know, more people that we kind of were relating to, and that really helped, you know, to kind of with the shift, you know, coming from Mexico and staying here.
And then when you moved from Mexico, what did you feel like you had left behind?
I still think about it, you know, because I think I could have a very successful career as a computer systems engineer in Mexico. So I felt like I left what I liked a lot and changed it for what I loved. So I don't really regret that decision at all, even though I still feel like, you know, my peers or kind of the students I went with at school, you know, they are kind of getting their masters in engineering, all that stuff. And sometimes I feel like a little sentiment, you know, in my heart. But I'm like, oh, you know, I'm really happy here. I'm doing what I love and I'm getting paid for it. So it's actually a cool thing as well.
Well, talk about that. You came here and you were a computer engineer, didn't have any winemaking skills. You just got sort of a whim. You wanted to make wine. What was that process of becoming, you know, a winemaker at a reputable winery in Oregon?
Yeah, well, first it was the decision and the guts to take that decision. Then actually developing a plan that will ultimately kind of yield, you know, that accomplishment of that goal. So what I found, you know, was to really improve my skills in English a little bit. So I kept going to English classes. While I was doing that, I went to Chemeketa. So in Chemeketa, they have like a winemaking program, an agriculture program. So I grabbed kind of the list of books they were using, you know, for the classes, and I started to study in my own. The cool thing about the Oregon wine industry is that if you have a question or something, you know, you ask anybody, they'll tell you a lot of stuff, a lot of details. They're very friendly. They really want you to learn. You know, if someone is actually willing to learn, they learn. So I was studying the books. When I saw questions or I had questions or something, I just went to different wineries and they would, yeah, you know, they would actually answer that question. And I even kept a log of all the questions I had and the answers that they gave by the name of the winemaker that actually gave me that question. I still have that book, you know, I still refer to it sometimes. And it was really cool. So I learned a lot that way. But the thing is that I started working in the vineyard as well, where I was kind of going for the English classes. And I was learning on practice as well. And from people above me, you know, vineyard manager and actually the winemaker. My first job was as a vineyard worker for Patricia Green Cellars. And my dad was actually a vineyard manager here at White Rose. But back then, he didn't have this winery or anything like that. So I worked for like 6 months for Patricia Green, and then I moved to White Rose, working in the vineyard for my dad. And basically, I met the owner of White Rose. He saw my interest in wine and everything, and offered me a position, a full permanent position in the vineyard. And then once he built the winery, since he's from California, he had to travel back and forth, so he needed a person really to look after, you know, his wines, and hire me. So I was working like half time in the vineyard, half time in the winery. But you know, he was making the wine with the help of Mark Vlosek as a consulting winemaker, and really I had access to that guy, and I kind of, you know, squeezed his brain with a lot of questions and learned a lot of stuff while doing it, while practicing it, you know, so that really helped quite a bit.
You took a lot of leaps of faith. I mean, that the story, the journey you were on is pretty incredible to get to this point. You took a lot of leaps of faith. Were you scared at all during it?
I think the most scared decision was to stay here, you know, and pursue that without knowing anything. But once I set the goal of becoming a winemaker and kind of the plan I was going to follow, I kind of found a lot of people along the way that were kind of willing to help and willing to actually teach me something. It's kind of like, you know, when you want like a blue car and you drive and you start noticing all the blue cars. And so I think it worked that way like this. You know, I set up the goal to become a winemaker and I kind of found people that were willing to kind of help me a little bit, you know, towards my goal.
What is the food that makes you think most is like home?
Pozole, which is like a hominy soup with pork. It has like a different chili pepper sauce, and you add like a lot of vegetables to it. And that really, you know, when I tried that stuff for my mom, I think I'm basically in Mexico. I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is good.
And this is sort of a piggyback on that, but what do you think, so there's the pozole, what else is something that you sort of have brought with you that is sort of a tradition or something that is meaningful to you that reminds you of home?
Well, I think youth family reunions, you know, are the ones that really, when you are gathering around with your people, you feel that, you know, you're in your home, you know, and being birthdays, being, you know, like church things as well, like the Virgen de Guadalupe Day, like Christmas and all those kind of things. When we get together, you know, it's kind of like you bring with you the value of family, kind of, you know, which is such a little different from here, you know. I mean, they value the family, but they're all around everywhere, you know, and sometimes they don't even talk to each other. I think for Mexicans, you gotta have kind of that connection with your family members. And that's how I felt, you know, when I was deciding of staying here or returning over there. I'm like, I'm gonna be over there, I'm gonna see him once in a while, but really, it's gonna be really that long. So I'm like, you know, if I stay here also, I will see him more often. And now I even work with him, you know, which is a pleasure to do, you know. And so I think the value of family is what I bring with me. And
when I've been saying home, I've been talking about Mexico, but it sounds like home is where you have that family support.
Exactly, is what I feel, yeah.
If you could have a grandparent tell, you know, either a child or a grandchild something, pass something on, what would that be?
I think as far as my grandparents used to tell me, it's basically responsibility and hard work. You know, you earn everything through hard work and through being responsible of yourself, you know, not like, you know, sometimes you blame outside circumstances, no, but taking responsibility of you as your future, you know, not caring about what others say, what other people, you know, say or anything like that. I think that's what they instill in me, the sense of responsibility of myself, responsibility on the job, and also hard work. That they always said that the only place where, like, I think it's the same in Spanish as it is in English, the only place where success is before work is in the dictionary. And I think it's the same in Spanish, so that they used to tell me that all the time. So you gotta really work hard to have the success you want.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, no problem, my pleasure.
That was Jesus Guillen, winemaker at White Rose Estate and Guillen Family Wines. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. Jesus recorded that interview as a part of the Inheritance Stories project, which you can learn more about on The Food Show page on the KBOO website. So we're coming up on Thanksgiving, and it is time to plan that Thanksgiving meal. The mashed potatoes and gravy, Brussels sprouts, stuffing, etc., all is a very important place on the table, but the centerpiece of most Thanksgiving spreads in omnivorous households is the turkey. To talk with us about the turkey, we have Lisa Migrant, owner of Raven and Rose in Southwest Portland, with us in the studio. Lisa has put a lot of thought into selecting and preparing that perfect Thanksgiving turkey and is here to share her knowledge with us. Lisa, welcome back to The Food Show.
Hi, thanks, Chris.
So first off, could you tell us some of your Thanksgiving family traditions that involve the turkey?
Yeah, I would say that Thanksgiving's always been a big, important holiday for my family. I have a big, large family, and there's always a bunch of people that come. And we always have, the thing that's a little bit different about us is that we always cook our turkey on the barbecue. We tend to cook everything on the barbecue outside, rain or shine. And we tend to cook the whole bird on the barbecue with hardwood charcoal and some hardwood smoke. So that's a little bit different than most people do, and it's a little bit more challenging, but I think the result is worth it. And in more recent years, the last, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 years, we've really focused on sort of sourcing the perfect bird rather than just getting a grocery store turkey. We've worked really hard on sourcing an ethically raised, you know, sustainably raised, but delicious pastured heritage turkey as well.
So we're going to talk about both the preparation and the sourcing of the turkey, but I first want to get at the why. Why is going all out when cooking the turkey so important?
You know, for me, Thanksgiving only comes once a year, and people really, a lot of people, it's their very, very favorite holiday, and you only get to cook a whole turkey really once a year. Very few people cook a whole turkey any other time of year. You don't have a lot of practice at it, and it's a really important symbol, and it's something that people look forward to for an entire year. And so you're really putting some time and energy into it and focusing on it. It seems just important because it's a really special part of the holiday.
Well, it does seem like you have to relearn the process every single year because you're only kind of doing this once a year.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's pretty easy to go wrong, and nobody wants, you know, sawdust for turkey for Thanksgiving dinner. And that can happen. So you do kind of have to think about it and then do as much work as you can and cross your fingers and hope it comes out right.
So let's talk about the turkey itself. How do you go about finding the right bird for Thanksgiving?
Well, so for me, trying to find a pasture-raised bird that's been given a good life and gotten to live outside in the fresh air and the grass and the bugs and the sunshine is really a top priority for me, both ethically and also for nutrition and for flavor. And my advice is to start at your farmer's market if you're lucky enough to have access to one. There are usually farmers that farm other things all year and will do at least a few turkeys on pasture a year. And so start early in the year and make friends with farmers and talk to them and see who's doing turkeys and see if you can't get one set aside for you ahead of time, because usually they get snatched up pretty quickly.
So you probably have your turkeys ready to go at this point, or at least
we do have them sourced. I mean, the last few years doing the restaurant, Thanksgiving's a work day for me, and so we're focused on creating a perfect Thanksgiving experience for other people at the restaurant, and we do have them picked out at the restaurant, but in my personal life we would have them picked out by now for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any advice for folks who are still looking for that Thanksgiving turkey at this point?
Yeah, I mean, again, I would go to the farmer's market and really talk to farmers, because even, for instance, like we've done at the restaurant this year, we source a lot of our poultry from a place called Range Shed of Al Rancho, which does pastured meats, and they don't have turkeys this year, but talking to them, they have a network of friends that are farmers that may not be big enough to have a website, may not be present at the farmer's market, but they network through a single farmer, and we found a farm that's got turkeys raised the way we like. And so ask people, see, do you have any friends? Do you have anybody who's raising turkeys that might still have one available? And you can find them.
And you mentioned some of the benefits of having this, the pastured turkey. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Like, how does it affect the flavor of the turkey, the way it was raised?
Sure. So there's a big difference. I'm kind of a bird nerd. I've got a fairly large flock of heritage breed chickens and ducks and geese at my house. And so I've been watching them kind of my whole life run around and live their lives. And knowing the difference between that and factory-raised birds, it's just they're worlds apart. So standard conventionally raised turkeys are generally raised inside in giant barns, and they are fed feed that's just meant to make them as big and fat as possible, as quickly as possible, with taking up as little space as possible. This creates a big, soft, kind of bland flavored meat very quickly, and that's what's best for, you know, business for the big farmers, and they're trying to be the most efficient. A bird that's raised outside in a more natural environment, and for turkeys in particular, they are native to this continent, so it really is their natural environment. They're running around, they're getting sunshine and grass and bugs, a much more varied diet, and you are what you eat. And so they're going to get stronger muscles. They're going to be a little bit leaner, but it just creates a more intense flavor in the meat for sure, and also happier birds. And then nutritionally, having a more varied diet like that and getting, in particular grass, they get a lot of beta carotenes and omega-3s, fatty acids that you wouldn't normally get in the packaged feed for birds. So they're actually, it's like grass-fed beef or wild salmon. You're going to get better balance of omega-3s to omega-6s. So it's a healthier meat for sure.
What about the breed of the turkey? How does that play into this?
That's a good question. And it's a little bit hard to answer. It's a little bit intangible. There are lots of beautiful breeds out there, and they come in lots of different shapes and sizes, and they all have different personalities. So some of them tend to eat more and stay a little bit more stationary. They're more like couch potatoes. A lot of times they're going to get a little fatter. They're going to be a little juicier, but they might not be as intensely flavorful as the ones that are out running around all over the pasture, flying up into trees, hunting down birds and bugs and grass and nuts and things like that'll sort of add to the flavor of the meat.
And so we've talked about sort of sourcing the bird in an ethical way. And so somebody who does that, of course, wants to prepare it as perfectly as possible. So what about the difference between preparing one of these pasture-raised heritage breeds versus a conventional turkey?
Yeah. So again, you kind of have to think about body type and then also the style of meat. So anything that's pasture-raised or wild is going to be leaner just by its own nature, because it's going to be on a leaner diet and also going to be running around getting exercise. And a lot of the heritage birds have a not quite as broad and thick a breast meat, and so they cook faster, or at least differently, and so you kind of have to pay attention to that. So I always recommend brining, especially a heritage bird, help retain some of that moisture and get flavor in there, and then just cooking it very, very carefully. When in doubt, buy a thermometer and look up the right temperature for poultry and when it should be just done, and check it at the thickest part of the thigh and get it out of there as soon as you're anywhere close to that. Underdone when you cut into it is better than overdone, because you can always pop it back in the oven or on the stove for a minute. But once you've overdone a turkey, especially heritage breed, it can get dry pretty quickly. So you want to be very careful. And there's also other fun ways to do it. You can wrap it in bacon or cull fat, you deep fry it. People do all kinds of things to get a little bit of fat content there and retain the moisture.
And then there's so we've talked about now selecting the turkey, there's preparing the turkey for Thanksgiving, and of course we don't want any of the bird to go to waste. So what should people do? Would you have any creative recommendations for the leftovers from the turkey?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, the sky's the limit, I suppose. There's always standards of turkey soup, turkey white bean chili, turkey sandwiches, things like that. My very, very favorite thing to do is turkey enchiladas. Shred up that leftover meat, white or dark meat, doesn't really matter, and saute up some onions and make some tomatillo sauce or some red chili sauce and roll them up and bake them in the oven. Just about anything you can imagine, turkey... Tetrazzini, exactly. Turkey tetrazzini. It's turkey and eggs for breakfast, or there's just a million things. So just try and get creative and look up recipes so you don't get sick at the turkey in the 2 weeks that it's probably going to be left over because you made such a giant bird.
Now, I don't want to leave out some of the other amazing foods, and we've been talking about meat, and so let's give the vegetarians some due. What are some interesting side dishes that you would be preparing for this Thanksgiving?
Yeah. My family, we always do pretty traditional things. We always do the mashed potatoes and gravy, a very simple, veggie and herb stuffing. My mom always makes angel biscuits, which is an old recipe that came from a friend's great-great-grandmother from the 1850s, and it has yeast and baking soda and baking powder, and they somehow magically come up into these perfect little bread rolls. But one of the fun things we've done at the restaurant last year, and we're going to do it again this year, is our take on the sort of traditional sweet potatoes that people do with the sugar and marshmallows, brown sugar and marshmallows and pecans. We kind of make a savory version of that and put it into a pasty, since we do British Isles food at the restaurant. And so a pasty is like kind of like a hand pie. And so we make a savory, caramelized, sweet savory, caramelized onions and sweet potatoes and pecan filling, and wrap that in pastry and bake it. And then we put a fresh marshmallow on the top and torch it, so it's burnt marshmallow on that. It's kind of a play on that dish, which is really fun. We tried to have fun with takes on the really traditional classics that you may not even think of as that exciting or that good, but they can really be delicious.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with Thanksgiving, a lot of it is about tradition. So you cook the same things every year, mm-hmm. and it only comes once a year. So it's even exciting to have those, but you do want to have a little bit of that kind of playfulness. And it sounds like that's one of those dishes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we always like to make basic, really standard things and then pick a couple of things to do something really fun and different, because even if you fail at the new experiments, most of the other things will be good at home. You know, you can give it a shot. Plus, the side dishes are important, because if something goes wrong with turkey, you've got plenty of food. Otherwise, one year our dog took the entire turkey off the barbecue, and we had no turkey.
Oh, that is so, tragedy.
Yeah, but you know, if you have enough side dishes, you get through anyway.
So. You mentioned that you're going to be working on Thanksgiving, so I'm curious. For me, Thanksgiving, you know, a part of that's so great about Thanksgiving is the process of cooking. But I imagine that's just for a meal with some friends, some family. You'll be creating the Thanksgiving meal for a number of people at the restaurant. How do you go about planning and executing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you have to plan way ahead of time. And it really is, it's almost a surprisingly popular holiday for restaurants. We book up very quickly and very early, and so we work really hard, probably a couple of months ahead of time, to source turkeys and find a farmer that's got the right heritage breeds for us and enough in quantity for the restaurant. And we plan out a menu, and we kind of sit down, kitchen management sit down and brainstorm all of our favorite sort of almost kitschy classics from Thanksgiving, and then think about how we can make them awesome. And we really find that people calling in for Thanksgiving want the classics and want a traditional family style Thanksgiving experience. And so we put together a menu and put up there, and we do one big, long, very busy service. And then at the end, my staff sits down and we have our own sort of family Thanksgiving at the end afterward, which is really fun. Everybody looks forward to it every year. I mean, if you have to work on Thanksgiving, you got to make it fun.
Definitely. Definitely. Lisa, I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving this year, and thank you very much for joining us on the food show.
Oh, you too. Thanks so much, Chris.
That was Lisa Migrant, owner of Raven and Rose in Southwest Portland. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. Another common Thanksgiving food is the winter squash. A delicious storage crop, winter squash is great for the pantry, able to sit on the shelf a long time before you decide to prepare it. Josh Volk, a farmer and small farms advocate, had a special winter squash on his shelf for nearly a year before he cooked it. He tells a story about that winter squash that leads into a conversation about dry farming. Here is Josh Volk, recorded at his home.
I've had this squash sitting on my counter since last fall. One of the things that OSU has been looking at with this squash stuff, and I think, I don't remember if I was one of the people that encouraged them to do this, but I think a lot of the farmers, and we've been working with OSU now, Alex Stone in particular, and Lane Selman, for probably 10 years or something like that on projects like this. So they're looking at the store, like, how does winter squash store and all these details? And it turns out not that many people have looked at it. But I've been dry farming winter squash for about, well, on and off for about 6 or 7 years now. I've always been curious whether or not them having less irrigation means that they actually will keep better. And I still don't know. Alex is looking at it more carefully, so she might. But anyway, this custard that I made just this afternoon, I had this butternut squash sitting on my counter, and it was like, well, it's squash season again, so I might as well use this thing before the next squash comes in. So I cut it open. It was still totally fine. It had a couple real small little dots on the outside, but it would have kept for a while longer. So it was a little bit, a little bit dry, but I baked it, and it has absolutely no sweet. The squash had no sweetness at all. It had lost all of its sugar. And it had kind of this weird tartness. So I'm hoping that doesn't mean that it's terrible and it's going to like make you completely ill. But but I thought, well, the texture is still really nice. It's like still this really nice creamy texture. So I'm going to make a custard. But I didn't want to measure anything because I was going to make it really quick. So I just tossed in an egg and some yogurt, which probably makes it even more tart, and some sugar and then a bunch of spices. And I was baking dinner. Making dinner in the oven anyway, so I tossed it in the oven for 20 minutes, and it's pretty good.
Does that mean all that sugar goes into the seeds? I mean, or did you know maybe it wasn't that sweet in the first place?
Well, so one of the things that Alex has looked at, and so I've been seeing her charts of this, is they, they take a certain number of the squash out of storage every so often and cut them open to test them, and one of the things they test is dry matter. And I think that's basically like, how is the squash dehydrating over time? So this, how's the texture changing? But another thing that they do is they do a Brix test, and that's the test of how much sugar is basically in their dissolved solids. And there is a point where, so for some squash, one of the things that was really interesting to me that I always thought that squash basically needed a certain amount of time for in storage before the Brix hit its peak, and then after that it would tail off, so that it would start going down. It turns out that there's a few squash, so I think it was delicata type, some delicata types, and acorn squash, where they basically peak at harvest and then it's all downhill from there. But butternut and a number of the other storage ones, they have a peak which is much later. So maybe November, December. I don't remember how the charts figure it out. And they're storing things at different temperatures and different conditions, so they may be different for different conditions. But then there is this point where it's like, okay, that's the peak, and then it starts going off. And I assume, I don't know, but I kind of assume that it's just a transition from one type of carbohydrate into another type of carbohydrate. So it's from a carbohydrate that tastes sweet to us into a different type of carbohydrate that doesn't taste sweet to us. And part of the reason I assume that is because that's something that happens in potatoes. So if you store potatoes in very cold temperature, like 32, 33, 34 degrees for an extended period of time, and then you cook it right away, they actually taste sweet, like that you can taste the sugar. And it's a problem for processing, because if you're making potato chip and it has that sugar in that form, then it turns dark really fast. So you have to condition the potatoes before you fry them so you would bring them back up to temperature that's more like 45 to 55 degrees and let them sit there for 2 weeks after they've been in that really cold storage. So they'll store for longer in that really cold temperature, but they'll develop these sugars, but then they transition back into a different type of carbohydrate. So I'm kind of assuming that's what happens in the squash, but I don't know any of this. So
sure.
I'm making that up in my head, as I do with most things in the farm world.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like we're on the cusp of people are actually now researching it.
Yeah.
So these things that you're making up in your head maybe will either be totally demolished by what the science says, or it'll be proven.
right. Yeah. So hopefully they're going to look at all that and they'll be able to tell us.
You know, you mentioned dry farming as the method that you use to create this squash. And I think that's a really fascinating subject.
Especially after this summer.
Oh yeah. Especially after this summer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I know you do dry farming, and the problem with it, people say, is what do you do when there's even less water,
right?
Like, will dry farming work, or will it be too dry for?
Yeah.
So I'm just curious with you, what about your experience?
Yeah.
With dry farming, and
so the first time I ever heard the term dry farming, it was in conjunction with tomatoes, and I was down in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was living down there, and I wasn't farming actually. I was working as an engineer and going to the farmer's market, and there was a farm. Wish I could remember the name of it, but a farm over kind of in the Santa Cruz area, and they had, in the fall, they had dry farm early girl tomatoes, and they were the most incredibly sweet, flavorful tomatoes. They were small, but they just had this amazing flavor. They had a little bit tougher skin, really, really tasty. And I went on a tour of the farm and garden at one point over in UC Santa Cruz, and Jim Leap was basically talking about the technique, and so I kind of heard more about the techniques for these tomatoes. And he was saying at that point they unfortunately one of the fields that had been where they had dry farmed the tomatoes at UC Santa Cruz, they were turning into housing. I don't remember if it was dorms or what it was. As one of the things that they did when they did that, they had all this heavy equipment out there, so they were digging a bunch of stuff. And so they went ahead and took advantage. They were doing studies on the soil so that they could figure out the foundations for these buildings and everything. And they were like, well, okay, well, as long as we're doing this, let's take a core sample and kind of look at what the soil profile is in this field where we've dry farmed tomatoes right after the tomato crop is there. And my memory is that Jim Leap said that they found tomato roots more than 50 feet down in the ground. So, it's like, I think most people, you got a raised garden bed or something, and it's like a foot or two deep, and you're thinking, oh, that's as deep as the plant roots go. But the plants have this ability, especially deep-rooted plants like tomatoes, to go down way, way further than a foot or two. And really, we could, with the soil water holding capacity, if you have a deep enough soil, those roots can go down and they can access it 2, 3, 4, 10, 20, 30 plus feet down. I've heard alfalfa going down 130 feet, 150 feet, basically unlimited until you hit bedrock. That's a much bigger reservoir to hold water than what most people would typically think about. And in a climate like this, in particular in California, basically has the same climate. They're just on the drier side. We get plenty of rainfall for producing vegetables on the annual basis. It's just that it comes in the at the wrong time of year for most of the things that we want to produce. So it's coming in the winter where we want to be growing the plants in the summer. So we need a way to store that, and soil is the way that we're storing that. I mean, the other way that we're storing it is in snowpack and in lakes and in rivers and that kind of thing. But basically, it's being, if you can store it right there in the soil and then access it somehow, that would be great. So that's the idea behind dry farming, is basically in a climate where you get winter rain, but you have a dry summer and you want to grow the crop in the summer. Dry farming would be not irrigating at all, but using techniques that help conserve moisture and that also help encourage the plants to root as deeply as possible and to take advantage of that deep water.
Well, and it seems like, I know you're heavily involved in small scale farming and agriculture, and it seems like dry farming is just another tool that small scale farms are able to use.
Yeah, so although you kind of get into one of the tricks with dry farming. So one of the things that you do with dry farming, which isn't appropriate in small scale agriculture in the same sense, is that you basically space the plants way far apart. So you take up a lot more space in order to get the same number of plants and essentially the same amount of production. So it takes more space to grow the same amount. Now, there's savings. Space is not one of them. So, maybe it's appropriate small scale, maybe it's not appropriate small scale. If you're talking really small scale, which is my big interest, which is very, very small scale, then that kind of thing is the complete opposite, where we try and stuff everything as close together as possible, but then irrigate and take as much advantage of that irrigation water as possible by only irrigating a very small area. So this is kind of the exact opposite of that, where it's like, okay, we're not going to use any irrigation water at all, but in order to do that, we're going to have to spread out into this very large space. And there's some things about dry farming that actually might be considered not great for the soil, in terms of you're trying to really leave the soil bare so that there's not other plants competing for that same water. So there's a lot of bare soil involved. It's not the other problem with it is that every season is different. So, it's like this year we had a really early end to the rains. So, and then a very hot summer also. So we cut the water off early, and then we actually had a higher, like the plants needed more water during the summer because it was so hot. And in other summers, you know, it'll maybe rain all the way June. We might even get in early July and there'll still be some kind of significant rain. And in a year like that, it's a very different situation than this year where basically it stopped raining almost in March. I mean, I think we got a little bit of precipitation in April and maybe May, but nothing very significant. So, you know, those are two very different years, and you're going to have really different results in those two different years. So
I want to go back to what you were saying about your main interest is these micro farms, where you sort of pack things in and make it work. And I'm curious what you see as, like, what's the role of the micro farm in the food system and in the agricultural system?
I don't know exactly what I think about it. I think when I started getting interested in this whole thing, and John Jevons was a big influence on me early on. I was actually an engineer, like I mentioned before, in Palo Alto, California, which is where John Jevons did his initial work. So that's where he started out. So John Jevons and Ecology Action still had a garden store in Palo Alto. And in fact, I think it still exists. But when I was there, they still had this garden store, and I had just read his book, and I was working in, kind of volunteering on the weekends in some community gardens in East Palo Alto, which is a whole nother crazy story. But I got very inspired on this, how to grow more vegetables in, you know, very, very small space, and how could that be applied to community gardens and, these areas that had poor access to vegetables. So East Palo Alto is a very poor community and didn't have good access to vegetables. And also they didn't even have playgrounds or that kind of thing. And so it was a great community or parks. And so it was a great community gathering space for the adults, but also for the kids in the community. And so it just seemed like, oh my God, there's all these things coming together that are so fantastic. And so John Jevons talks about, oh, well, you know, large scale agriculture and you're wasting all this space and you could grow it on, you know, with so much less water and so many less resources and especially so many fewer calories, essentially, you know, fossil fuels is what that system is built on. And fossil fuels is a lot of calories in the energy sense. And they're cheap calories. They're very, very inexpensive compared to other types of calories. But if you're looking just at calorie per calorie, it's much more efficient to grow on a very, very small scale. And so if you didn't have fossil fuels, which are this cheap source of calories, you would go back to a much smaller scale agriculture. And so I got really excited about urban agriculture, and it was kind of like, oh, this is going to be, you know, great for everything, and it's a complete win-win. But as I've gotten into it more and understand more how cheap fossil fuel is and how much that drives the price of food, and, you know, basically you can transport it from far away and it costs you almost nothing to do that transportation, that really has a big impact on, you know, what the role of, I think, small scale agriculture is. But small scale agriculture, like this really micro scale agriculture, still has all these other benefits that I think are really fantastic in terms of the community aspect and connecting people to their food supply. Just being a gathering point. And so I think I was talking to a group of urban agriculture students a couple weeks ago and who were kind of doing planning stuff around urban agriculture. And what I said to them was, I think that it has a role in cities in a similar way that the parks have a role. So if you were to think about the economic value of the land, you could make more money doing pretty much anything else with the land other than producing food on it, because food can be produced so cheaply in other places and then shipped with almost no expense for the shipping to the cities. And factories, retail, housing, all of that has a higher value per space than food production has. But if you think about public parks, I mean, public parks doesn't have any, economic value, or at least people are just starting to apply those economic values, but they're still everywhere. And the sign of a good city is having these. And so I think that there's more reasons than just the economic value of that space, and that they need to be thought about, like these small-scale urban farms need to be thought about in more similar terms to parks than a factory that's producing something, or a retail space that's selling something, or low-income housing, or even fancy condos or something like that, which are going to produce more economic impact per space.
So I want to talk about, you mentioned earlier the calorie input, the fossil fuels and transporting food. And I want to talk about, so you are somewhat iconic in Portland. A lot of people have seen you biking with your cargo bike. But so I wanted to ask you just how, that experience of biking long distances with these boxes of vegetables, what was that was like?
So I had this very small farm, I worked on farms that were kind of 5, 10, 15 acres for a number of years, but I had that start in urban agriculture where I really wanted to get back at some point to John Jevons' ideas of doing the hand scale thing. And so I had a farm project that I did on Sauvay Island for about 4 years, so just outside of Portland. It was close enough to, it was hand scale, so I was doing everything on the farm by hand, but initially I was driving out to the farm, so driving my car out to the farm with my tools, and then driving the produce back into Portland and distributing the produce. And I have a background, I used to be a bike racer, so I love bicycles. I was a mechanic for all through high school and college, and raced bicycles through college, and then I got a real job and didn't have time to race anymore, and so I stopped racing, kind of stopped riding bicycles for a long time, but I've always had this love of bikes. Had thought, wouldn't it be great if I could ride this produce instead of drive it? So it didn't really have an economic benefit, other than I could spend the time driving, which I don't like to drive. I could spend this time driving doing something that I enjoy instead, which is riding, and at the same time delivering stuff. So there was this bike shop that I found that had just opened, and they were selling cargo bikes. And it was just, at that point, I think it was really kind of a one-man operation, this guy Joel. And I met him because I was actually looking for a completely different bike for my partner. And it turns out he didn't have anything that was appropriate for her, but he had these great cargo bikes. And I told him my story, and it was like, oh, but these cargo bikes are way too expensive or whatever. And he's like, oh, you should try one. And I was like, they're just way too expensive, I can't do it. And basically about a year went by after I left the shop that time, and I kept thinking about it and kept thinking, oh, it really would be great to do that. Maybe I'm going to try it. And I borrowed another friend had a cargo bike, which was not as fancy as the ones that Joel was selling, but I borrowed his cargo bike and actually did a delivery one day, and it was like, this is great. I'm going to go back to Joel's shop, and I'm going to, kind of see whether or not I can make this work. And he had offered a test ride, so I was like, okay, I'm going to go back and ask him if I can do that test ride. And he was like, yeah, I'll do the test ride. I'll lend you a bike for a week, and you can try it out. And he was like, and I came back, and he was like, we got to make this work. And so we figured out a lease arrangement. So they kind of can say, instead of sponsoring a racing team, which a lot of bike shops do, it was like they're going to sponsor a farmer. And so it was still a decent amount of money for me and for the business. So economic, if I had been making the decision straight economic terms, it would not have penciled out. It still would have been cheaper to drive the car because I wasn't really driving it that far. It was close enough that I could make it work month to month. And so they leased me this bike. And I did that for 3 years, actually. So started on Sauvay Island. So that was it was 8 miles from my house to Sabe Island, and then 8 miles hauling the vegetables back into town. And then I would go to a yoga studio that I've been going to for years, which is another 8 miles from my house. So it was basically a 32-mile round trip. And that was fantastic. That was perfect distance for me. And then the farm moved, and it moved down to Sherwood. And I thought, well, I've been doing the 32-mile round trip. Now it's a 56-mile round trip. I could probably do that. So I started doing a 56-mile round trip, and that was super fun, especially passing all the traffic that was backed up on 99 coming into town, doing the deliveries. So I did that, and then after 3 years, the farm kind of got shifted enough that it got big enough that it didn't make sense anymore. And the original agreement with Joel, which was really the way that I wanted to do it, was, I just want straight lease. You guys take care of the maintenance. I'll ride the bicycle, pay you this lease rate. And then when it's over, the bike is yours again. So the bike went back to the shop, and I don't know. I'm not sure they were going to sell it as, refurbish it and sell it as a used bike. I'm not sure if it's been sold yet or not, but I missed that bike. It was a great bike. And I'm looking for my next farming opportunity to... to have an excuse to go back to riding the bicycle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so lease another bike from them.
Yeah, it seems like they need to put it up in, it's a museum item. This bike
I rode that bike about 15,000 miles.
Okay, that was my next question.
Yeah.
That bike is,
so that bike had a lot of miles on it. And actually, one of the incredible things that I couldn't believe was the rear tire on that bicycle, I finally got it to fail, but it took over 13,000. I think it was about 13,000 miles for the rear tire to wear out. And in that 13,000 miles, so Joel, the guy at Splendid Cycles, so Splendid Cycles is the shop that set me up with it. He puts super heavy duty tires on it and then puts slime in the tubes. And that was something that I never would have done before. But in 13,000 miles, I never had a flat tire. So the first flat tire I got was when the tire failed after 13,000 miles. And it was incredible.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Well, Josh, thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Josh Volk talking about a winter squash he stored for nearly a year, dry farming, and biking his produce from farm to city. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. And that's it for this episode of The KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Jesus Guillen, Lisa Migrant, and Josh Volk, for being on today's show. I also want to thank our wonderful board operator, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of December for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown. Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food. And those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right.
800 billion on defensive, planning new ways to blow each other around. But even 1% of that budget could stop a whole lot of hungry sounds. People need food in their belly, need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same. Me wonder if we're gonna stay afloat.
Thank you, Brian Kutian. The time is 12 noon. You're listening to 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland. And now a little news at noon.